Before taking up the cases today, let me just make one housekeeping announcement. After the third case of the morning, 23-1213, the state of Alir versus Wahira, after that case, we will be taking about a 10-minute break. With that said, we're ready to hear. I'm sorry, I apologize. After 23-3074, Awiha versus State of Kansas. After that case, we'll be taking a 10-minute break. Apologize for that. Now we're ready to hear the first case of the morning. Please.
Well, counsel, and don't count this against her time, please, but as you argue, whichever case that you're arguing, whether it's 1211 or 1049, would you please be sure and tell me which case that this argument is going to so that I can follow along, all right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Caitlin McHugh, and I represent defendants Maggie Barch and Trellis Holdings Maryland, Inc. This case is about a federal court's power to award damages based on ownership in a company that is illegal under federal law. This question is central to both appeals. Regarding the 2024 appeal, this court should vacate the judgment as void under Rule 60b-4 because the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction. Regarding the 2023 appeal, this court should reverse the Rule 69G turnover order because the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction to enter the order. I'd like to discuss three points today, starting with the second appeal, the 2024 appeal. First, why the district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction to award money damages, and second, why the arguable basis test should not be applied to challenges of constitutional standing under Rule 60b-4. Then I would like to turn to the 2023 appeal and discuss why the district court lacked jurisdiction to enter the Rule 69G turnover order. First, subject matter jurisdiction. The district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction because it could not provide relief where the only remedy sought by plaintiff was to share in the financial gain of Cultus cultivation and distribution of marijuana. The district court improperly vindicated an unlawful ownership interest by awarding damages that could only be derived based on future profits in selling marijuana. A necessary component of standing is that the injury is redressable, and an injury is only redressable if the court has the power to order such relief. Kaiser Steel talks about these ideas in very mandatory terms.
Let me be clear on one point. At least I heard you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the only way that the damages can be gained is through the sale of marijuana. Why is that so? I mean, the district court entered a money judgment for damages of a certain amount of money, $6 million, some amount of that sort, and said, pay it. I mean, if your client was situated to get the money and pay it some other way, they could pay it. I mean, is that not correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. But my point is slightly different, is that while the judgment could be satisfied with any monies, that is fungible. The basis for the judgment could only come as a result of the sale of marijuana. In this case, the only injury complained of was a lack of ownership, deprivation of an ownership right in a marijuana company. And under the 10th Circuit Baca case, there must be a substantial nexus between the injury complained of and the relief granted. So if you were deprived...
Counsel, now let me ask you this. In regards to that, in the complaint that was filed, I think there were 8 or 9 different causes of action, one of which was just simply breach of contract, which is what the district court granted its verdict on, was a breach of contract for money damages of $6 million plus dollars. That hadn't got anything to do with the marijuana or anything like that.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The contract.
Well, I didn't expect you not to, but.
The contract at issue was whether he owned an interest in marijuana. And because you have to have a substantial nexus between the injury and the relief, what the district court was looking to do in vindicating that contract interest was saying, yes, we will award money damages based on your ownership in a marijuana company.
All right, is that a way of saying that you contend that the contract is illegal?
The contract is illegal and the remedy sought is illegal.
And you have not, and you did not argue that the contract was illegal on appeal in the other appeal where you should have made that argument. And so why isn't that waived? I mean, how can you make that argument now, particularly in the context of a collateral attack under 60B4? Why can you make that argument?
Your Honor, first, this is not a collateral attack. It is a 60B4 is considered a direct attack under the Glen Hill case.
It is not a direct appeal. And therefore it is after judgment. And so let's go with that. How can you make an argument of that sort after judgment when you did not make that argument prior to the judgment being entered?
Because this type of illegality is a subspecies of illegality where vindicating the contract would require the court to actually order illegal conduct. And the standing is so important within our constitutional system that it can be raised directly at any time.
Okay, let's break that apart because those are two different things. I mean, one is the question of whether there is some act of ordering by virtue of what the district court does, affording a remedy, it is requiring the exercise of illegal conduct, that take place. That's one thing. The other question is whether the underlying contract itself is illegal. And I heard you to be talking about that initially, were you not?
I'm talking about both, Your Honor.
Okay, well, let me take the one about the contract being illegal. And the point I'm making is you waived that argument. We're talking about whether the remedy is going to be a violation of the Controlled Substances Act. Other than that, in the context of this 60B4 action, what authority do you have that would allow you to raise this argument of which essentially is saying the contract is illegal now, this shouldn't be the basis for it? Well, you had a chance to make that argument. You didn't make that argument.
Your Honor, I believe it can be raised because the illegality of the contract goes to whether the court can enter the relief under Kaiser Steel, and if it is a remedy that the court does not have the power to order, then it goes to
standing. That's the point I'm making. That's a conflation of two different issues. The one issue is the contract illegal? The other is, by virtue of the remedy that the court chooses to exercise, be it, in this instance, it's a question of simply you have the turnover order in the other case, or just the entry of damages. Well, let's assume for the moment that you've waived the issue of the contract's illegality. Aren't you really just stuck with the question of whether the award of damages for an assumed legal contract is somehow or other a flawed matter jurisdictionally?
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree that it cannot just be the illegality of the contract. It has to go to whether the court had the power to enter the remedy.
Okay, then just go with my assumption for one second. I know you're not conceding anything, but just go with that assumption. If for whatever reason we cannot challenge the illegality of the contract, what is it that's going on here that would render the judgment void?
It is because the court is vindicating an interest in a cannabis company, which is contrary to the CSA, contrary to the Controlled Substances Act. And under several cases, district court cases, including the Sensoria case, those courts have consistently held that a court cannot vindicate an interest in a marijuana company.
Well, counsel, that I think that circles back to the first question you were asked this morning. The court ordered $6.4 million in damages. Didn't order divestment of an interest. It ordered a general order about damages. Why couldn't the defendant satisfy that damage award through something independent of the business? In other words, if they had other assets, they could sell a house, they could sell a car, borrow the money. What makes it tied to the business at that point in time? I'm not talking about the next case. I'm just talking about this one.
Sure. It's not the way that the remedy would be satisfied, that the damages would be paid, but the nature of the damages themselves. Where did they come from? Because a court can't enter damages out of whole cloth. And here what the court did is it looked at what the value of Colta, the marijuana company, is. And so for Colta to have any value at all, it required the court to assume that it is going to consider selling marijuana.
Well, counsel, assuming that your client did have assets independent of the business and could satisfy the award, where's the violation of the Controlled Substances Act?
The violation of the...
He writes out a check for 6.4 because he has a mansion somewhere, a yacht somewhere, that he could sell and satisfy the award. Where's the violation of the Controlled Substances Act?
It's, again, vindication of an ownership interest. In the In re Malal case, the bankruptcy court there discussed that not only is it contrary to the CSA to own a marijuana company, but also to sell an interest in it or to use any monies from that interest.
Could I just, before we leave this, I have a slightly different question. In connection with the 60B4 motion, you argue that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time. Of course, it was 5 years before it was raised. There was no appeal from the original judgment. So why isn't the no arguable jurisdiction test from a case like Espinoza the applicable test here?
Yes, Your Honor. The no arguable basis test within the Tenth Circuit has only been applied, aside from one unpublished case, in circumstances where the lack of subject matter jurisdiction came from interpretation of a statutory grant of subject matter jurisdiction, so that within the subject matter jurisdiction system, right, the first level for a court, a lower court, to have any power is it must be a case or controversy, and that is determined by standing. And only once you have standing can you build upon that second layer, the statutory grant of subject matter jurisdiction. And those two are different because the constitutional piece is immutable. It's not changing. It's a fundamental basis of our system that ensures separation of powers. Whereas at the second level, when the courts come in, Congress comes in and gives a statutory grant of power, that changes over time. An arguable basis is necessary to ensure that subsequent changes in authority or changes in the law would not cause
Espinoza, but Espinoza was the Tenth Circuit, was it?
No, but Espinoza also found that it was not a case where the U.S. Supreme Court would determine the bounds of when 60B4 could be raised. In fact, it says that this is not a case where we get to this issue. And it also relied on a Second Circuit case whose basis relies primarily on issues of res judicata, whereas in this circuit, res judicata is inapplicable to 60B4.
I'm interested in how far this could go. What if you'd waited 20 years to file the 60B4 motion? Could you still make the same arguments?
If you identified that there was a lack of subject matter jurisdiction based on a constitutional infirmity, I believe that you could. But I think those circumstances would also be exceedingly rare. This has come up one time in the 23 years since Gushwin was decided. I would like to turn now to the second appeal quickly and talk about that. The arguable basis would not apply to that case because it was timely appeals. And TransUnion states that anytime there's a remedy, for each different remedy, you must separately analyze standing. Here it was ordering, the court was ordering Mr. Bartsch to divest in ownership in an illegal company. And under In re Malal, that would be illegal.
Well, counsel, that presupposes, though, that your contract argument fails. In other words, the adjudication of the $6 million, that judgment stands because your second appeal is saying what we're saying now, in order to collect the $6.2 or $6.4 million, what the trial court did in aid of execution was actually ordering a violation of the CJA,
well,
whatever it is, in recovery. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's a different argument. You have to give up on the first argument to argue that in aid of execution, the trial court in the second case could not order what he did, because that would be ordering a violation of the felony laws of this country.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe if we were to prevail in the 60B4 motion, it would vacate all judgments because there wouldn't be a judgment. But if the court disagrees and upholds the district court on the 60B4 judgment, we could still prevail on the 2023 appeal because the court did not have standing to issue that order.
Well, I'd like to hear you go in depth a little more about why that constitutes a violation of the laws.
Sure.
What authority do you have?
That would be the In re Malal case, and in that case, the court held it was illegal for a marijuana company to incorporate, to solicit investments, and to sell securities, and co-contaminantly, it was illegal for the person who has the securities to do anything with them. I believe that would be a violation, according to that court, of Section 854 of the CSA. It would also be 856 and 18 U.S.C. 2. Additionally, I believe it would violate RICO and money laundering acts under 1956 and 1957. I could reserve my last 15 seconds.
You can just take another minute, and I'll give the other side another minute if you want it.
Sure.
You can either go now or take it in rebuttal.
I will take it in rebuttal, please.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'll be sure to ask you to do the same thing. Identify which one of the two numbered cases we're talking about as we discuss. Sorry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Judge Holmes. May it please the court. I'm going to start with 1049, second appeal, which is really where most of the discussion took place. Most of what you heard from my friend Ms. McHugh was simply an argument of an affirmative defense of illegality that was never raised, that is waived, that is nothing to do with jurisdiction. Ms. McHugh cites Kaiser v. Mullins, which was a case that they discussed a lot in the district court, didn't even put in these briefs, now have resurrected. That's a case that talks about illegality, antitrust illegality in that case, but it's not a standing case. It's not a jurisdictional case at all. Censoria, which they rely on to say that courts may not adjudicate issues like this, contracts like this involving the CSA, the court exercised jurisdiction and adjudicated the merits of the case. Dismissed some claims on 12b-6 in Miser v. Bush, I believe it was Chief Judge Holmes, noted that a 12b-6 decision is an adjudication on the merits. So there is no jurisdictional issue here. Even if there were, what we're talking about under Rule 60b-4 is voidness. And the Supreme Court has told us for 199 years that the mere erroneous exercise of jurisdiction does not equal void. So in Espinoza, the Supreme Court logically said that a void judgment is a judgment that is a legal nullity. Going back to 1825, McCormick v. Sullivan, which is discussed in the Chico County case from the Supreme Court in 1940 that has been cited multiple times by this court. The Supreme Court made clear that while inferior federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, that if such a court exercises jurisdiction erroneously, then, quote, their judgments and decrees are erroneous and may upon a writ of error or appeal be reversed for that cause, but they are not absolute nullities.
Counsel, could I just ask you to clarify one point? In your brief, you rely on diversity to say that there was an arguable basis for jurisdiction, but what if there was no arguable basis for jurisdiction based on standing?
Well, I think that's one basis that we assert.
Well, how can that be right? I mean, you can have diversity, but if there is a complete lack of jurisdiction under Article 3, then you don't have an arguable basis for jurisdiction, do you?
Well, the question is whether there is an arguable basis for having standing, or to flip it around, whether
I'm just questioning whether your reliance on diversity is a complete answer to this issue.
Well, we've never said it's a complete answer.
Well, I think you did in your brief. You said that the fact that there was diversity means that there was an arguable basis for jurisdiction. That can't be right.
Well, what we were referring to there, Your Honor, was the court statement in United States v. Lambert, on which Your Honor sat, where the court noted that because jurisdictional statutes were applicable, that provided an arguable basis for the court to exercise jurisdiction. Now, like here.
But that isn't what they're arguing here. They're saying there was no standing. And so was there an arguable basis for standing here? Why don't you address that?
Sure. The arguable basis for standing was that this was an ordinary contract case in which any judge would think that there was standing because the plaintiff was injured. He got injured. He sued for those injuries. He sought damages if his merits argument was accepted. Those damages would redress his injuries. And what my friends are doing is saying they're posing an incredibly novel theory for why that ordinary standing analysis in an ordinary contract damages case should not apply. And that theory is that there is something special about the CSA that changes that.
They're saying the underlying subject matter is illegal, that therefore we could not vindicate a harm related to an illegal substance. So my question initially for you is, to the extent that law has to determine whether there's a property interest here, is this state or federal law? What law determines whether there's a property interest in this?
This is a diversity case. It was state law that applied.
And as it relates to state law, obviously, in both Maryland and in Colorado, it's legal.
Absolutely.
Well, all right, but let's go beyond that now. And so their argument is that you cannot vindicate an interest in a legal substance. And so that's what makes us different. That's what makes us not an ordinary contract. What do you say to that?
Well, I say a number of things, the different layers of the analysis. Starting with whether it's illegal, they assert that vindicating an interest in equity in a cannabis company violates the CSA, but there is no provision of the CSA that violates. They filed two briefs in case 1049. They did not cite a single provision of the CSA that prohibits anything.
Well, they cited three statutes and RICO this morning. And we have this case that they also, your friends also cited, in I may be mispronouncing, In Re Malul. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, In Re Malul is a bankruptcy court case that made general statements to that effect, citing section 854, 21 U.S.C. 854, which we address in our briefs in the first appeal, which has nothing to do with it. That's a statute that says it is illegal for a principal violator of the CSA to take proceeds and invest those proceeds in an interstate or foreign enterprise, except there's even exceptions. It's not completely barred. You can take your $1 million of cannabis proceeds and invest it in Microsoft stock on the open market. And as long as you don't require 1% or more of the equity of the company or get the power to elect a director, then it's not even illegal in that circumstance. Well, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. The relief that Judge Jackson ordered is simply pay money. Pay money. He didn't order anybody to grow cannabis, to aid anyone who grows cannabis, simply to pay money. And actually, even if the proceeds, even if the judgment were to be paid with proceeds from a cannabis operation, that would not be improper, because since 1872, the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Planters Bank v. Union Bank has made it clear that courts have the power to order parties to distribute funds, to pay a judgment with funds that are the proceeds of illegal activity, as long as the court does not affirmatively aid the illegal activity, because otherwise avowed lawbreakers would claim and would have a special immunity from federal judgments by invoking their own supposed lawbreaking.
Would you say that the Ninth Circuit Shulman decision is the closest case to support that point in terms of the cannabis business?
It's related. It is the one that specifically addresses and rejects their Article III standing theory based on redressability. And, you know, I would submit that alone shows that the district court in this case cannot have plainly usurped its power by not conjuring up their CSA standing theory.
Well, counsel, before we get too far along, I want to go to the second where we're talking about an aid of execution on the judgment. That the learned trial court in this case ordered that the interest be sold in a marijuana business and that that money be paid over to your client.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, why? And I'm just saying for purposes of argument, I'm assuming that the original judgment is a good judgment and all we're arguing about is an aid or execution of a lien or whatever. But why specifically isn't the trial court's order in that case violate the terms of ordering the sale or possession or dealing in a marijuana business? And that, to me, is pretty clear could be a violation.
Here's why it's not. Because the district court's order will not foster the sale, one additional sale of cannabis. If the defendants comply with the district court's order, the cannabis company, Culta, which has the operations, will receive no capital, will receive no other financial services. All that will happen is instead of judgment debtors being the passive owner of a minority 31% interest in the company, then that 31% will be owned some smaller amount by somebody else and by judgment debtors in a smaller amount. But it is entirely neutral to the operations of the cannabis company. And this is the same argument was made by a United States trustee and rejected by the bankruptcy court for the Central District of California in the In Re Hacienda case. A very thoughtful opinion that actually addresses also the same argument was made about 18 U.S.C. 1956, the money laundering statute, and the court says that when there is a divestment order of this sort and there is a sale of cannabis interest or equity in order to pay creditors, then there is no fostering of any additional sale, any additional growth of marijuana, and therefore there is no violation of the statutes that actually are in the CSA, like 21 U.S.C. Section 841, which prohibits you know, the manufacturer, distribution, possession with intent to distribute of marijuana. It's simply taking equity, selling it, and the money then gets distributed to pay creditors because the money is not going to further the criminal activity or conceal criminal activity. That's why the money laundering statute doesn't apply.
What if the enforcement order does violate the Controlled Substances Act? What's your argument then about standing?
Well, I think it has nothing to do with standing. I think if there is an extant order that violates the law, the court can say that order, that particular enforcement mechanism should not be enforced. But that's not a matter of standing. And that's why it's also important here.
Why isn't it? I mean, what you've got, there are cases, in re Syngenta being one, that talks about this notion of post-judgment actions on providing remedies, and talks about the fact that that's essentially a separate litigation. And then the question becomes, is there standing to get that remedy? I mean, why is that not appropriate?
Well, I think if the court, the case law is, I think, clear that, I see I'm out of
time. Go ahead, please.
That if the court had jurisdiction to issue the underlying judgment, if the underlying judgment is not void, then the district court has ancillary jurisdiction to enforce it and to consider enforcement mechanisms. If an enforcement mechanism is not proper, then, you know, the decision of this court should be that mechanism is not proper, but that doesn't change the ancillary jurisdiction that the court always has to consider requests for enforcement.
Okay, I mean, I think I understand that point, but the way that would play out then is that we're focused really on the order itself and whether that order is a violation of the CSA and therefore, or in some other way, infirm. But it's in, at least I conceived of this as being a two-pronged analysis. One being the question of whether this order, whether the court had the ability to redress the injury of the person and you, because of your client. And therefore the question would be whether there was standing to do that. And I look at that in the context of, I spoke of in re Syngenta, which was an attorney's fees case. And in that case, you began again. And at that point, the question was, do you have standing to make the request for the remedy that you're seeking? Why is that not an appropriate way to look at this?
I must say I'm not familiar with Syngenta, so I can't comment on that, but I'm not sure that I have more to say than what I have. Supplemental proceedings are supplemental enforcement proceedings, but they are not it's not a new case, and the jurisdiction comes from the underlying jurisdiction. That's what this court has said in Atlas and other cases. But just to clarify,
can I ask you about Atlas since you just raised it? Because I thought this panel, as a matter of fact, after the panel determined the district court had ancillary enforcement jurisdiction, which I think is your argument, didn't the court go on then to determine whether the plaintiff had standing?
I don't recall, Your Honor, I must say. But the one final point that I'd like to make, though, is just to make sure that the court is clear, because my friends have tried to, in their reply brief in the first appeal, the 23 appeal, try to conflate different parts of the district court's Rule 69G order into one. So there's the part, which is paragraphs 1 through 4 of the district court's June 8th order, which is the order to divest, which is what we've been talking about. Okay. But then in paragraph 5, there's just a separate part that is just a straight, ordinary Rule 69G garden variety turnover order that says, even if, that regardless of whether judgment debtors are forced to make a sale or really forced to exercise their best efforts to try to make a sale, that if they voluntarily make a sale and therefore have money from that sale, that they must turn over that those proceeds to the judgment creditor to pay the judgment. That's not an order to sell. That's even if they voluntarily sell, they must turn over the proceeds to pay the judgment. That's a standard classic Rule 69G turnover order of the type that Chief Judge Holmes and Judge Matheson dealt with in, for example, the Grupo Cementos case. And so,
as fascinating as this is, we're going to have to wrap it up. Okay, so I understand your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go with 4 minutes.
Your Honors, I disagree with my colleague. The property interest analysis is federal law. It's the Barnhill v. Johnson case, and it's cited in footnote 1 of our first supplemental brief. That case says that, generally speaking, when looking at if there's a property interest, you look at state law unless there is an overriding federal interest. And here there is an overriding federal interest because of the Congress's comprehensive scheme under the CSA. I believe also the Supreme Court's decision in Raich talking about that upholding the CSA would also go to that point. Regarding the illegality of the acts, in addition to the statutory authority, there are numerous cases that have found that vindicating an ownership interest in marijuana violates the CSA. In addition to In re Malal, I point you in our briefing to the Gopal case, In re Barton, Jay Lilly, Next Steps Advisors, Polk, and Sensoria. All of them have looked at the issue and concluded that a federal court cannot vindicate an interest in marijuana.
Well, didn't Shulman undermine Next Step?
Respectfully, no. Shulman said that it could, that there was statutory standing, constitutional standing where the injury complained of was a business injury, an injury to a cannabis business and other property. And so in considering standing, the Shulman court was not looking at the narrow issue of, is there standing to vindicate an ownership interest? It was looking much more broadly, and it was doing this at the 12B6 stage.
Constitutional standing to vindicate an interest in a harm to a cannabis property. How is that different than having a property interest or an equity interest in a cannabis business?
It's different because the courts have found that if there is an injury that is different than seeking profits or ownership, they can in fact do that. For example, in the Jay Lilly case, it was an equipment lease, a lawsuit brought by a cannabis company to enforce an equipment lease. And what the district court said is, we can enforce the equipment lease because that's not the dealing in cannabis, but we cannot award profits because that would be violating the CSA. And that's the distinction that numerous courts have taken. That's what Sensoria has done. Some of them have said, we can return an investment, but what we can't do is give you profits. And here, all the plaintiff wanted was profits because the company had been very profitable. It was asking the district court to award millions of dollars that was the value of the company because it had been selling marijuana. Whereas Shulman, at the 12B6 stage, it was really only talking about an injury to a business, and the pleadings were broader. It talked about, it did seek profits, but it also sought an injury to some land and that some salaries hadn't been paid. It was broader, and so there was room for standing.
Let me just make sure I get to one point, though. What I understood you say is that we need to look at these cases that have concluded that there wasn't standing, that sort of thing, in this context. Well, I mean, in terms of a mode of analysis, why isn't it appropriate to look at the CSA and essentially juxtapose it to what we have at play here and say, what terms of the CSA does this violate? Why? And doing that, I've scratched my head to figure out why this is illegal. Certainly when you're talking about the turnover order. So why isn't that an appropriate mode of analysis?
It is a place that you can start, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
Now go ahead, finish your answer.
But once you realize that marijuana itself, the sale of marijuana, is illegal, there are vast statutory schemes or statutes that make it legal to do really anything with that business. And so it's not just the CSA that is implicated, that Congress has done a good job. Consider, for example, if this was heroin and you were and a person came into court and said, I would like to vindicate my interest in a heroin business. It would be very easy to say, no, you can't do that in federal court. Congress has said heroin is illegal. But because of the oddity of where marijuana is with the state system, and you can't walk down the street without seeing a marijuana business, it's easy to forget that it is, in fact, under federal law, the same as a heroin business.
Okay. I'll take that point and consider it. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Very well done. Appreciate the case is submitted.
Thank you.